The last time books were sold right off the shelves in Malaysia was when Albus Dumbledore was killed by Severus Snape. That was more than 10 years ago. I have with me in the studio, in this very special interview of Awani Review, one of the two co-authors of Billion Dollar Whale, Tom Wright. Tom is a Pulitzer finalist and also an investigative journalist from the Wall Street Journal, here making his media rounds in Malaysia. And I'm rather fortunate to have him on board to discuss the ongoings with the book and perhaps a little bit about 1MDB itself. Tom, thanks for joining me today. With regard to sensationalizing the book, do you think that you're sensationalizing the book?
No, and you know, frankly, we got pretty sick of the taunts that we were getting from the Prime Minister's office under the previous administration. You know, they constantly said we were liars, and they acted as if we were some kind of political force, as if we were taking sides in a political story here in Malaysia. Now, that simply is not true. I mean, the Wall Street Journal were just reporting on the facts, and now with the book Billion Dollar Whale, it's really what happened, and what's in there. If you're reading it, you can be sure that it really happened. We have busted our guts to talk to over 100 folk to get documents, reams of documents. I sat in a room writing this with Bradley Hope, my co-author, and we just poured through thousands and thousands of pages of WhatsApp messages, bank transfer documentations. We triangulated all kinds of different investigative documents. So when people say that we're sensationalizing it, I have very little time for that. This is true crime fiction.
Okay, hang on.
Non-fiction.
I've got a... of course. It does sound like fiction because of the way the story is being told. It's told in a crime thriller story. This morning you were talking about, you know, nobody wants to read about money trail stories. It's very boring. It has to be written in a very sensationalized story for people to keep on reading on. But there are moments in the book where I sort of got the impression that... It's as if you yourself were there. Was that the case? For instance, when he was changing pictures on the yacht, you know, when he was a young lad in Penang, how do you dramatize such moments? How do you even put that moment in an accurate position?
Well, you need to talk to multiple people who were there and who know what happened. And you're not. This is not hearsay, right? When we have a scene in the book. So, for example, we have a scene, that scene you referred to, we have a scene where Leonardo DiCaprio and Jolo and 22 Playboy Playmates are in a room. Well, we talk to the Playboy Playmates who are in the room, right? That's how you build scenes. You don't make them up. You don't fantasy. You know, it's not a figment of my imagination. But it's incredibly hard. It was incredibly hard work to get people, to identify people. You know, we got hold of email servers that show all the correspondence between various people, between the people involved in Red Granite Pictures, for example. And from that, you can find people who were at the events and talk to them. And that was really the reporting that we did for this book.
And of course, speaking about reporting for this book, there are a lot of presumptions by a lot of critiques on the book that you did a lot of creative thinking along the way to fill in the gaps where some scenes just need to have that continuum. Is that even true?
No. Yeah. Like I said, every single scene in there is backed up by multiple recollections. Where we sparingly use direct dialogue, but where we do, it's more than one person remembering it. And oftentimes, it's not just people remembering it, but it's also based on videos, photos, or documents that also give us even greater understanding of what happened.
I'd like to focus a little bit about the underrated character that you were mentioning this morning in that interview, where Otaiba, the Mubadala key figure, who is also the ambassador of UAE, is rather less spoken about in this book when essentially he's central to the figure. Why did you choose to not speak about him that much as opposed to other characters in the book?
Well, it's actually he's fairly prominent early on in the book. It's not that in that question, what I was saying was that I think people haven't really realized that Ambassador Otaiba in Malaysia and other readers haven't really realized how important he is to Jolo's rise. That's what I was trying to get at. This figure, who's the current United Arab Emirates ambassador to Washington and a very prominent ambassador in Washington, was a key facilitator of Jolo's rise because Jolo got to know him when he was at Wharton. And Otaiba helped to introduce him around the United Arab Emirates. And 1MDB was actually born out of an idea to replicate a fund called Mubadala in the Middle East, which had billions raised billions of dollars on public markets and went out and bought lots of Western companies. And Jolo saw the power of those kind of young executives in the Middle East who were running those funds. And Otaiba helped to bring Middle Eastern investment to Malaysia. And when Jolo was able to do that, that's what stood him in good stead with Najib and Rosmah. And they then started to trust Jolo, and that's how he got into their inner circle.
Another key figure that you say was Rosmah Mansour. She was the key figure into how Jolo got into power or close to power in Malaysia. Again, the way I read it, and I read the book twice, it doesn't seem that Rosmah was that prominent the way you would say depict Jolo.
Her role, I think, was basically, she was the entry point, another entry point for Jolo into the center of power in Malaysia. Because Jolo knew her son, Jolo had been at Harrow when Riza Aziz, her son, was studying at LSE. And they all had houses in a complex in London called Kensington Green. Jolo's father had a place there, Najib had a place there. And so they would spend, Riza is a little bit older than Jolo, but they would spend their summers there. And he was knocking up against powerful Malay politicians. And he was useful to Rosmah. He actually helped set up an offshore account for Rosmah's daughter, Rosmah and Najib's daughter, Noriana's funding of her education at Georgetown. And so he was there and he was helping her out. And it was really when Jolo started to bring Arab money into Malaysia that Rosmah really started to trust him. Because I think Rosmah and Najib, they really looked to the Middle East as a model for what they wanted to be, very powerful figures in the same way that some of these Arab politicians are very powerful.
Right, we'll take a short break, but when we come back, we'll discuss about the larger theme that I found to be in the Billion Dollar Wheel. Don't go anywhere. Thanks for joining us today. We are with Tom Wright, one of the co-authors of The Billion Dollar Whale. He is a Pulitzer finalist and a journalist of Wall Street Journal. Tom, I just want to pick out the major theme coming up from the book, because a lot of book reviews keep on telling the story of the major theme to be greed and lust and what money can buy. And you sort of like reaffirm this in various interviews from CNBC, BFM, many others that I've watched prior to this interview, saying that what can money buy? Right? That's a big question. But the way I look at it is, after reading the book twice, I think the major theme is on the failures of capitalism rather than anything else. How could $6 billion be transferred through across various parties and none picked up on that red flag? Do you think that that is something that you want to unearth writing this book, or do you still want to stick on that whole crime thriller thing?
No, I think you're right on the money. Well, I think it's both. It's a true crime thriller, and it's exciting, you know, romp through what you can buy with billions of dollars, including entry to Hollywood and a girlfriend like Miranda Kerr. But it's, as you say, it has a more serious edge to it as well. And you're totally right. It's amazing that the global financial system did not pick up on these red flags. And the reason is, if you're making people millions of dollars and you're making them rich, people are willfully ignorant or they turn a blind eye. Jolo touched people. Everyone he touched became extremely rich, right? From models who he met on the casino floor and gave chips to all these bankers. He took over BSI, the Swiss bank, and turned all of those BSI was almost, you know, failing bank in a way, right? And he turned them all into superstar bankers. They were living rock star, superstar banker lives. He turned Malaysia, small economy, into one of Goldman's biggest profit centers anywhere in the world, right? And what the Department of Justice is now looking at is, and other regulators in America, is did Goldman miss red flags? Well, I think for sure they did, right? Like we recount in the book one instance where 1MDB asks for $3 billion to be deposited into BSI, the Swiss bank I just referred to. Why would a sovereign wealth fund need a Swiss bank account?
It's to keep money away from the taxmen.
That's the main reason you have a Swiss bank account, right? I mean, 1MDB could have had a bank account with CIMB or any of the banks here in Malaysia. It did not. Why? And that was a red flag. And even Goldman's own lawyers flagged that to them on the transaction. But it still went through. And I think one of the reasons is this was an extremely lucrative trade for Goldman and for everyone else involved in it.
I'd like to hang on that, because it's not just the red flags that have been raised, but they still proceeded with it. One example that you gave in the book was that the initial transfer, the $1 billion and $700 million of that $1 billion was transferred into a trust account called Gold Star. And there was a hiccup in a Swiss organization. I don't remember what the bank was called. But Joe Lowe and one of his associates flew to Zurich, spoke to the banker, and persuaded the individual or individuals to pass through the payment. That kind of persuasion keeps on happening or recurring in that book. So do you think there comes a point in time where, you know, the larger story is not just about Joe Lowe, 1MDB, Malaysia, whatever, but to improve on the way capitalism is being managed in the 21st century?
Yes, totally agree. So, for example, you're referring to, I think, Rothschild's or Coutts, one of the two banks that, that were dealing with those flows. And Joe Lowe flew in with, I think, Casey Tang.
Tang, yes, absolutely.
And they, the compliance department of that bank in London, or, no, in Zurich, sorry, was saying, look, what is this transfer? Why are you moving so much money? It doesn't make sense. And they made up some excuse about it being an investment agreement, right? But it's clear from, if you read Billion Dollar Whale, it's clear, and as you say, I totally agree with you, that the checks and balances that are supposed to be there, right? Banks are supposed to self-regulate when it comes to stopping their institutions being used for money laundering. It's not there, and it's not working. Because time and time again, you know, there's a scene with this bank, Falcon Bank, in our book, mm-hmm. where the CEO of Falcon Bank, this guy called Lehman, who was formerly of Goldman, he's chewing out Joe Lowe on the phone. And this, we know this because the transcripts of this conversation are in the Department of Justice lawsuits. And he's saying, Joe, this is ridiculous. You're trying to move hundreds of millions of dollars, and this is just a joke. And the transfer goes through anyway. Why is that? Well, because, you know, Falcon Bank was owned by Abar, and there was the cover of some very powerful individuals in the Middle East and in Malaysia. And that was Joe Lowe's genius. It was getting the cover of powerful people and then hoodwinking them, because those people did not understand the full extent of what he was getting up to.
There was one question that was asked to you by a news organization in the U.S. where do you believe that Joe Lowe was a psychopath or thereof? Do you think so?
You know, I don't like to try to pretend I'm some kind of, I don't want to do pop psychology on Joe Lowe. I think he is an incredibly interesting individual. I feel like, you know, through writing this book, it's almost like we've been living with him or trying to understand him. And it is incredibly difficult. We've talked to a lot of people who spent time with him. And most people's recollection of him or of his actions is this sort of anodyne character, nice guy, got them, was very careful to make sure they got what they wanted. But just now and again, you get a sense of another character, a sort of darker character, maybe one who hates to be alone, for example, needs people around him. It's totally restless, just traveling the world on his jet, almost non-stop.
The word that you used, or Bradley perhaps collectively used, is that he is never in the moment. That was something that struck me.
I think that's right. I don't think he ever can enjoy what he's doing at any one moment. He's always looking. For example, you know, recently he was living in Thailand, right, after he was exiled from Malaysia. And he went.
Which was asked by Najib, actually, in 2015, right?
Asked to leave by, not formally exiled, asked to leave Malaysia by Najib because, you know, the focus on it after the media started to report on Joe Lowe. He was living in Thailand for quite a lot of the time. And he would take his kids to the aquarium in Bangkok, and they would sort of rush through because he couldn't do anything slowly. And he would be on his phones. He had multiple phones the whole time. It's almost as if he's searching for something. Right? Searching for some kind of happiness through doing these constant acquisitions, needing to be the center of attention, needing to be the person giving out favors all the time. But what's a mystery to me after 3 years working on this is, what was Joe Lowe's end game? You know, what was he trying to achieve? And that is, you know, that's less easy. And we try not to give a conclusion in the book. I think readers can make up their own minds.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps you shouldn't even, because this is something that is very subjective.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And we tried not to be subjective about him in the book. You know, we sort of report on Joe Lowe, but I think you'll find, and you've read it twice, we don't cast judgment necessarily. We try to be as sort of dry as possible in the way that we portray him.
Right, we'll take a short break, but when we come back, we'll discuss a little bit about his role, Tom Wright's role as a journalist investigating 1MDB. Don't go anywhere. Thanks for joining us this evening. Today, I have with me the co-author of Billion Dollar Whale, Tom Wright. He's an investigative journalist and also Pulitzer finalist from the Wall Street Journal. Tom, I just want to understand a little bit better because, you know, I very, very hesitantly use the term journalist myself. I don't think I qualify to call myself a journalist the way you would so comfortably do so, largely because journalists tend to present stories on both sides. You tend to get to the bottom of the thing. You have an agenda in terms of finding the truth. That would be the primary agenda. Why then did you not discuss or reach out or try your best to speak to Joe Lo yourself, being that he's the center of the whole story of Billion Dollar Whale?
Well, we tried over and over again to speak to Joe Lo. I mean, one of the key principles of the Wall Street Journal is to give everybody the chance to reply to what is being written about them. And we would never write something without doing so. But over the course of 3 years, both working for the Wall Street Journal on stories and Billion Dollar Whale, Joe Lo did not interact with us in any meaningful way. His lawyers, did not answer very detailed questions we gave to them to ask Joe Lo. And his only real response has been to try to stop the distribution of the book by using lawyers to threaten independent booksellers and online stores.
And perhaps that's the thing that I want to ask. Why is this, disclaimer not found in the book in terms of you trying to reach out to Joe Lo and him or his lawyers or representatives with the good faith of giving substantive responses or replies? Why do you do this in an interview outside of the book?
Well, we decided for stylistic reasons in the book to keep citations out of the book because this is a narrative and we wanted it to read like a story. But you can rest assured that every single person in there, and this is not just Joe Lo, I mean, in the preface there is Britney Spears, there's Swizz Beatz, there's Alicia Keys in the book, there's every single person we contacted. You know, we mentioned Bradley Cooper once because he turned up at a party. We talked to Bradley Cooper's representatives. Everybody has been given the chance to come and say, look, this is right, this is not right. And that's an incredibly exhaustive process, but one that we believe makes it a very fair book.
The way I look at it is that America is set up with free speech. Countries like Malaysia, the laws are set up in a way where we couldn't possibly pull this off. And in fact, in the UK, because that's where the laws inherit anyway from Malaysia, do have very stringent defamatory laws. And in response, Joe Lo has exploited on this. Joe Lo has asked through his lawyers to stop the sale of the book in UK bookstores, in Australia, many others. Do you think that freedom of speech is something that needs to be heralded upon because you can get outputs like this and be fleshed to the public?
Well, I mean, I think what's for sure is that the First Amendment rights in the US are extremely strong and protect freedom of speech, and that's an amazing thing about America. I think the book will become available everywhere in the world eventually. Right now, it's not available in the UK. It is available in Australia, by the way. Despite letters that have gone out to bookstores, the bookstores I've heard from there have said, "Look, well, we're still carrying it anyway. If there's any defamation suit to be had, it's between you, the publisher, and the writer, and Joe Lo, not the bookstores, right?" But that was the legal strategy that Joe Lo's lawyers and Joe Lo took. And I don't think it's going to stop the publication of the book, and I think everyone's going to be reading it.
So. I'd like to know the real Tom Wright. It sounds cliche, but yes. But what's next for you? This is a preoccupation that you have. Some would even call it a mania this fixation of this character. But what's up with you?
My wife would call it a mania. I mean, she's sick of hearing about Billion Dollar Whale, that's for sure. I mean, to really do a book like this well, you have to live and breathe the subject matter. And like I said, we were locked in rooms, reading through reams of documents. And this story has not ended. That's what's so incredible here. I mean, we're currently negotiating for film rights for this, and there's a lot of interest. We should have an announcement soon on that.
Would you like to make an announcement here, right here, in the House of Hawani?
I would love to, but there's no deal yet, so you just have to wait. But it should be pretty soon. So we'll be doing that. And what's going to happen to Jolo, right? He's in China, as far as we know. He seems to be protected to a degree. Will he come back to Malaysia, where he's been charged in absentia? Will he face justice here? What's going to happen to Najib when his trial starts early next year? And then what's going to happen to all the other characters, all the minor characters who are still at large? And what's going to happen to Goldman, right? Goldman is the subject of an investigation in the US. Tim Leissner, who was the primary banker on the deal, is in plea bargain talks with the Department of Justice. So there's still a lot to play out in this story, and it's only just starting to gain traction in the US, amazingly. I feel like, you know, I did a round of interviews in the US last week on the TV channels, and a lot of people had not really heard of this story, right? It's hard for Malaysians to figure that. But, you know, lots going on in the US with the Trump presidency. And I think it's going to take a while, and it's going to take the Goldman angle to really make people realize how important this story is on a global level.
Do you think that you've lived up to the journal's requirements of being a journalist that serves the community, particularly in the context of pro-business and pro, you know, government, not pro-government, more like regulations, to have proper regulations in place, to have proper check and balances? Is the spirit of Wall Street Journal and you one and the same, or are you something different?
Well, we should be very clear that the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, which is what you're referring to, are conservative, and they back a free market libertarian view of the world. The news pages are run by a totally different set of people, and there's sort of a Chinese wall between the two. We don't go out looking for stories based on an ideological position. We go out looking for stories because, first of all, they're interesting, and secondly, because they're newsworthy, right? And then if they're true, right, we'll report on them. So those are the three things I say we would take into consideration while we're looking at stories. And this story, you know, the New Straits Times wrote about me a couple of years ago, the editor there, saying, why is Tom Wright is the Asian economics editor, why is he writing so much about this one MDB over and over again? Well, it was because it was such an amazing story with multiple angles and of great merit and newsworthiness to Malaysians and around the world. So we don't, those are the editorial decisions we make about news, independent of, you know, anything else. Is it newsworthy? Is it true? And does it matter? Basically.
In fact, you know, you do have a way of impressing upon the public in terms of making the story more interesting. Albeit that already the subject matter is already interesting. For instance, you have fantastic infographics. There was this one time, there was a microsite within the Wall Street Journal pages where you could click and follow all the money transfers. All that, was that like a one-man team, or you and Bradley, or is there like a collective thing?
Bradley's really the money trail guy on all of this. He developed this is the $1 billion into Najib's accounts,
yeah,
graphic, right, where you can,
yeah,
see it all. That was his baby, and that was, you know, he's been tweeting that recently to sort of knock down Najib's claims on Facebook that this money comes from Saudi Arabia. I mean, the allegations, you know, in the Department of Justice lawsuits contradict that, and all the documents we've seen and reported on in this book also contradict that. But yeah, I mean, infographics are important. We did a mini documentary about all of this a couple of years ago, which was part of the Pulitzer entry. And I think there are many different ways to bring the story to light, not just text, right? Yes.
Okay, final question. What will the title of the book be called when it is published in Bahasa Malaysia?
Oh, I don't know. I speak a little bit of Indonesian, but I'm not good enough. Somebody said buaya, is that right?
Yeah, crocodile.
Something with crocodile, yeah, in it. I don't know. I mean, obviously whale doesn't work in Bahasa Melayu, right? Because it doesn't have any connotation about casinos or nightclubs.
No.
It's just a whale.
No, it's just ikan paus. It's like...
Well, what do you suggest?
I suggest, a colleague of mine suggested, what was it? Gajah. So, you know, it's a proverb saying that you can see other people's faults across the sea, but there's this big thing, there's an elephant in the room that you can't see. So.
Tapi gajah apa? Gajah putih?
Gajah putih is a big one, yeah.
Gajah
right.
Besar.
That was my conversation with Tom Wright. If you want to follow on this conversation, just head on to astroawani.com or awanireview.com. Follow us on all our social sites. We will continue to have this conversation as we unearth a little bit more about, not just about $1 billion whale, but also 1MDB. That's it for me. Thanks very much. Same.